United States versus Smith. Okay, Mr. Schachter.
May it please the Court, Aaron Schechter of Kirkland & Ellis for the appellant Walter Smith. Everyone agrees that we had an admittedly biased juror who violated the court's instructions not to discuss the testimony with other jurors, and indeed discussed the testimony with another juror. And everyone agreed that that juror needed to be excused and needed to leave and couldn't remain on Mr. Smith's jury. Now, the only question is how far the misconduct spread, and what was the effect that that juror, juror number one, left on the remaining jurors. But we can't answer that question, Your Honors, because of the trial court's errors. We cannot say, sitting here today, that any of the 12 jurors who decided Mr. Smith's fate were able to remain fair and impartial and decide Mr. Smith's case on the basis of the evidence and not the testimony, not the statement made by juror number one that was spread possibly throughout the jury.
But I guess I have a question for you, which is, what we do know on the record is that juror number one, who is of course struck, allegedly tells somebody else that the trial testimony was, quote, hitting close to home. So we know that that's the statement. Only that statement in and of itself doesn't sound to me like something that's the equivalent of Smith is guilty or the police always lie or, you know, anything that would tilt you one way or the other. Only speculation would cause you to think that juror number one had been talking in other ways or to other people. So we have some reason to think that at least one other person heard this hitting close to home remark. Why was it not within the discretion of the district court judge to think that in and of itself is innocuous, and if I start voir dire-ing the entire jury or all the men on the jury, I'm going to make this giant deal out of it, and it would lead us down a path that would be very unproductive and possibly taint the jury much worse than just that.
Your Honor, the argument that questioning all the jurors would add fuel to the fire is something the government has put in its brief. It's not something the trial judge considered on the record and stated. The trial judge, his five-sentence analysis of this doesn't say, I'm weighing the benefits and costs of discussing this issue and tainting the other jurors by putting the comment in his mind versus doing nothing. The trial judge simply concludes that the statement is innocuous with no sort of reason explanation.
What, did defense counsel ask that the court examine all the men?
Your Honor, it's implicit from the record on page 15 that in addition to moving for the mistrial, that there was a in the off-the-record proceedings before they went back on the record, that the defense counsel requested and made clear the dangers of not knowing the effect on the unidentified juror. And so
so in that off-the-record discussion, he asked that the judge voir dire each of the jurors individually?
Your Honor, it's not clear what exactly was requested, but it can be implied from the record that the judge was clearly aware that the defendant was concerned with the possibility of not speaking to any of these jurors and the various effects would have on not knowing whether any of these other jurors were able to be fair and impartial. And back to Judge Wood's question about not all we know is the statement was hitting close to home. The record isn't even clear that that's the entire statement. We have the only discussions with juror number one were off the record. We have an admittedly biased juror's word that the statement was hitting close to home.
Was there a request by counsel to make this on the record, the entire proceeding on the record? Because then we wouldn't be speculating as to what the implication was of the position that was taken or anything. Was there a request by defense counsel or the government to put everything on the record?
Your Honor,
what mystifies me. Why an allegation like this is made and then the whole thing is not on the record?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record suggesting that either defense counsel or the government requested an interview with juror number one on the record. And the comment...
Or requested, let's say more broadly, the exploration of this problem. I mean, the judge decides to hold this in-chambers session, but you can get a court reporter in an in-chambers session. If the judge didn't think of it offhand, it seems strange that nobody else just suggested. I don't know that there's any reason to think that Judge Herndon would have refused such a request.
Your Honor, it's clear from the record that the court and the government and defense counsel were aware of a request to speak to these other jurors and try to identify them and figure out what their prejudices were. On page 15 of the short appendix 151 of the fourth day of the trial, defense counsel says, as I told you in the back, Judge, the problem I have is not so much with the comment. It's that we don't know who that was said to, what effect it had on the juror, and then we don't know what that unidentified juror said to the other jurors. So this shows that the issue, it's not so much with the comment, it's that we don't have any basis to conclude that any of these 12 jurors were able to be fair and impartial. And it's the government's burden in terms of a harmlessness analysis to show that there was no prejudice. It's not Mr. Smith's burden to show that. And this
So it's not defense counsel's obligation to request that the court ask those jurors the question, whether it was passed on and put it on the record. That's not defense counsel's obligation.
Defense counsel, Your Honor, clearly requested a mistrial and clearly explained to the judge all of the concerns he had with not proceeding. It's clear from the record that the trial judge had determined at that point not to do anything in response to the misconduct. And just because there's not specific requests for either individualized voir dire as a group, just because every one of those aren't on the record, there's no suggestion by the government at any point that there's been any sort of waiver of an argument.
Oh, no, I'm not trying to suggest that either. I'm just saying when you're in this kind of situation, you want to know exactly what's on the other juror's mind, that it would seem that a defense counsel would say, Judge, why can't we put this on the record? Why don't you voir dire them? I understand you denied our mistrial motion, but we think we're entitled to have answers to those questions.
Your Honor, the record doesn't indicate that the defendant made that, but I mean, this court's precedent has also recognized that when we have a situation where this court is left to speculate what occurred at the trial court level, the court isn't in any better position than the district court to figure out what happened, and the deference to the trial court should be limited given that we have no idea what happened at the trial court, and this court is in no better of a position than the district court to interpret that comment.
I have a question as to whether you think this sort of problem is subject to harmless error analysis or not.
Your Honor, I believe it is subject to harmless error analysis because it was explicitly raised in the trial court and the defendant's attorney clearly moved for a mistrial and it was denied.
So I guess my question is if the whole business about whether the jury should have been examined more and the rest of it is subject to harmless error analysis, then shouldn't we also be paying attention to how much evidence there was in this record against Mr. Smith, and could this possibly have made any difference to the outcome?
Your Honor, you are correct that the weight of the evidence is one of many factors that courts look at in the harmlessness analysis. And the prejudice to Mr. Smith can't be proven by the government beyond a reasonable doubt to be non-existent based on the utter lack of an investigation and the trial court's inattention to its duties in response to misconduct. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Shackett. Ms. Hudson.
May it please the Court. Jennifer Hudson of the United States. I'd like to make two quick points. First of all, defense counsel and government for the United States were back in counsel or back in the judge's chambers when juror number one was questioned. When this discussion was memorialized on the record, the court gave both counsel, including the defendant's representative, an opportunity to place anything they wanted on the record. And it is from the defendant's attorney that we learn that this is hitting close to home, is placed on the record. So we can assume that that's the totality of what was said. If there was more, if there was something else that would have been beneficial for Mr. Smith, his counsel surely would have placed that on the record. Secondly, although this is a secondary issue, there is another juror issue at the polling of the jury that I'd like to draw the court's attention to, trial transcript, day six, pages 3 to 4. One of the jurors is visibly upset during the polling of the jury. Judge Herndon turns to that juror and for 2 pages discusses with her, is this her verdict? Is there something that's forcing her to make this verdict? Is it against her will? And she says, no, this is my verdict. Now, while there isn't an individualized voir dire of each and every juror, or even the male jurors, including the alternates on this panel, there is extrinsic evidence that the infection that the appellant raises has not spread through this jury. Not every allegation of jury misconduct is sufficient to substantiate putting each and every juror or the 5 or 6 male jurors on the spot. It is quizzing the jurors, and it can impress upon them something more negative and cause them to take that back with them into the jury room. Clearly, juror number one was upset by the fact that these facts were hitting close to home, and he shared that one statement. Clearly, Judge Herndon exercised proper discretion in releasing him from the jury and then exercised discretion again in choosing not to individually question each of the jurors as to whether or not it affected them.
I'm just curious about this process of not putting everything on the record. You know, why wasn't that suggested by the government to put everything on the record? Then we wouldn't speculate as to exactly what was said. Rather than have a rehash at sidebar, you know, why, is this a regular practice?
Your Honor, I wish I had a better answer for you other than the memorialization of what took place in chambers was thought to be the best direction.
Yeah, but, I mean, now in hindsight,
you are correct.
Yes. Everything that with a juror, in my mind at least, should be on the record. Then we don't speculate. We're going to have a harmless error analysis anyway so we can weigh the evidence. But, I mean, we wouldn't be speculating about this. Then on the second point you made about individual voir dire, the jurors, it's a real simple thing to just say to bring each male juror in on the record, say, you know, did you have any discussion with anybody about the case or... You know, let the jurors answer, end of story, go back. They're instructed not to discuss the voir dire. I mean, this happens. It's a pretty routine thing.
While I agree with you that it is a very routine thing, United States versus Stafford said that it's not required in every case.
I understand that.
And that this court exercised its discretion in finding that statement, this is hitting close to home, is innocuous. It did not want to cause any type of uneasy feeling on the individual jurors by calling them in. The court has the opportunity to make that discretionary judgment, and he made that decision. I'm sorry, you had a question as well?
Well, it was really exactly the same as Judge Williams. I'm very concerned, to start with, at the lack of a record of the in-chambers discussion. People may even fail to report something that later seems to be important. I think it's a very unfortunate practice, if it's a common practice, and it's too bad it happened here. You might not even be here defending mm-hmm. this verdict if everything mm-hmm. had been properly laid out. Now, as Judge Williams also said, there's probably a harmless error step that we reached too, so we may be able to get beyond this. But I don't think this is any kind of model how to play the jury issues.
I agree, Your Honor. I do apologize. I can't change it. All I can say is that based upon what we have here, I don't believe that there's any cause to reverse the court's or the jury's verdict. Moving to the harmless error standard, I did lay out in the brief, and I don't want to rehash each and every one of the factors, but I believe there's substantial evidence to support that jury's verdict. We do have a look into the juror's mind with that secondary juror crying.
I don't read very much into that, though. People mm-hmm. have all sorts of reasons. I would not rely mm-hmm. myself on that.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that's a strong argument for you, just because she said it in front of everybody else. What you're thinking is then if somebody else had been bothered, they would have popped up and said, I was bothered.
No, that the court specifically asked her, is this your verdict?
But that was just one juror, and this comment was not made to a woman. It was made to a man.
But defendant's appellant's argument is that it had spread through the jury and that infected
that,
the jury.
But the only evidence that we have is that he said it to a man.
Right, and we do have evidence from this juror that it did not spread to anyone else.
Well, not to her.
Not to her. I mean, that. Yeah. So, but she's not a man. I'm saying if he says he said it to the man, she says, you know, no, I'm fine. Well, that's of no moment, at least as far as I can tell.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hudson.
Two brief points, Your Honors. There's no way to know, based on the record we have here, that the comment was and its effect was harmless. It's the government's obligation to get this all on the record, and they're here every day in the district court to make sure all of this happens properly. And the
I just want to stop you there. I think defense counsel also has a role to make sure everything happens properly. So even if the government doesn't suggest it, I mean, it saves. I mean, to have a record of exactly what was said really is really important, because then we're not speculating. So in my view, I think both sides have. Yes, the government's got the burden, but I think if the government doesn't suggest it, defense counsel suggest it.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, but the government here hasn't met its burden of proving harmlessness beyond the reasonable doubt, because the only thing we can do is speculate here. And the comment, if it was so innocuous, everybody agreed that we had a biased juror who couldn't even serve on the panel, and we're purely speculating to read into the comment what it meant without knowing how it affected any of the jurors who decided Mr. Smith's fate.
Thank you, Mr. Schachter. Thank you, Ms. Hudson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Schachter, I want to give you an additional thanks for accepting this appointment and to the firm. And I assume you left the Second Circuit because you wanted to come here for the weather.
Yeah, it's a little bit worse in Chicago, but I enjoyed my time here. And thank you very much for the kind words, Your Honors.
Have a safe trip home, both of you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Okay.